Bill Ludlow, thank you so much for coming on to Talk Leafs all the way from Arizona. So before we make a start, can you just give us a little bit of information about yourself and your background?
Sure. I'm 54 years old. I was in retail for most of my life, about 25 years. Grew up in Lansing, Michigan. Went to Michigan State University, completed 3 years, but there were a lot of things going on at the time. It's a long story. I never did finish, but I did study anthropology and geology there for 3 years. When I was in college, that was really when I first heard of this creation versus evolution controversy. Until then, I never knew there was such a thing. But with some friends of mine's roommates that were creationists, we ended up started talking about it, and they're talking about a 6,000-year-old Earth, and I'm, wow. So I guess it just kind of, I got interested in it at that time. And then with the internet in the mid-90s, I got online in like 1995, and just in surfing around the internet, I come across different forums, message boards, that kind of thing, where people were talking about creationism. So that was when I first heard of Kent Hovind and people like that, Ken Ham and stuff. And again, I was just, very interested in kind of finding out why these people believe the way they do. So it's been an interest of mine for a long time. Right now I'm semi-retired. I work about 15 hours a week. I volunteer at the Arizona Museum of Natural History 1 or 2 days a week, and mainly interacting with children there, or along with their parents. We get a lot of kids in during the school year, where they'll come in on field trips and things like that. This time of year in the summer, it's just mostly small groups and parents and that. But they really didn't have anyone doing anything with human evolution there. There's no permanent display. So they had put together something with 7 or 8 different skulls and the information on it and stuff. And so I've just kind of expanded on that down there. And I've trained now other people. We have a couple other people doing it. So we have most of the days of the week covered now.
You're the human origins expert, aren't you, at the Arizona Natural History?
Yeah, I'm in charge of training other people on the human origins cart that we have. They call it a cart, but it's basically a table that we set up in that for it. And the origins gallery, which is where they talk about, they have the displays and that about evolution in the museum. So, I'm kind of in charge of training the other people and that there and coordinating that. So,
yeah. Right. Okay. Well, first off, Bill, you live in the USA, of course, which has a heavy creationist presence and ranks pretty low in the world in terms of acceptance of evolution. In 2006, a survey placed the US nearly at the last place in the world, with only Turkey being less accepting of evolution. So do you think that acceptance of evolution in America is still pretty poor, or are things starting to get better?
I think it's getting better, absolutely. They show the trend, but it's just slightly. It's not a big trend. I think that's going to change. I think probably As the next generation grows up, and I think that there's going to be a lot more acceptance of evolution. I do think it's changing, but you've got the evangelical, element out there in the United States. It's just much stronger than it is in a lot of other countries, and those are the people that are rejecting it for religious reasons. So
it doesn't fit in with their Bible, and so therefore it can't possibly be true under any circumstance.
Right. Yep. So definitely.
And what really seems to be the most incendiary topic for religious people is the human origins question, that present-day humans evolved from lower primates. So what exactly do you think bothers creationists so much about the idea that we evolved?
Well, I think it's because it's personal. We're talking about humans. It's one thing to say, this animal over here or this plant over here changed over time and started out as something else, but it's another thing when they're talking about us. And I think that's it. They take it personally. The Bible says that we are created in God's image, and that doesn't jive with what the Bible says. You could look at plants, animals, anything else. A lot of people will accept that, but they don't accept humans because it just goes against what they've been taught, what they've been brought up to believe.
Yeah, so they will, in some cases, you'll have religious people who will accept the evolution, except they will draw the line at the human evolution parts. Oh, no, we do not come from animals. We're not animals, and we certainly aren't.
Right. Even a lot of old Earth creationists are that way. Definitely. They accept everything else, but then basically when it comes to humans, that's where they draw the line.
Yeah. Well, Bill, recently you took part in an excellent online debate with a well-known creationist apologist, Kent Hovind, about the evidence for human evolution. I encourage everyone to see that. I will put a link actually below.
Oh, thanks.
So people can check that out. Anybody who saw it, of course, will remember that he didn't even so much as bend on any of the evidences that you presented. So the thing is, he's very arrogant at times, Bill, even saying things like, I'll use small words so that you can understand.
Yeah. I had to bite my tongue through that debate over and over and over. That was, he took some shots at me. I just tried not to go there, and he tried to change the subject too. He wanted to bring it morality, and definitely, tried to change the subject. There were a couple of moments during the debate, where he got really upset.
I remember.
and one of them was, let me see if I can bring that slide up here. One of them was I put the slide up and I did it a little early. I should have waited just until I started talking. But if you can see that there, this mammoth thing. And once he saw that slide come up, started talking about carbon dating. You could tell he's like, he did not want to go there because he knew he was wrong. He knows that information he's presented for 20 years is wrong. That wasn't the same mammoth, he got that information probably from other Walt Brown had been using this, and he references Walt Brown in this slide, but on some of his other slides, he references the original source. But yeah, he just did not want to go there. He saw it coming, and boy, he just didn't want to talk carbon dating. Well, then he didn't even understand carbon dating. He kept asking me, if we carbon dated ourselves, well, we can't carbon date ourselves. We just went through this whole thing over and over about, something has to be dead 100 years. And he would say, but if we did, it's like, well, why? it's not going to give us an accurate result. There are some slides that you didn't see. Had ready to go. This is one he kind of talked about over and over. He talks about bones in the dirt. You can't tell everything. You can't tell anything. It's just all you can tell is something died. Well, here he is talking about Homo naledi in 2015, and talking about how we can tell from the hip bones that it. Walked upright. Well, there you go, Ken. They're right there. You're telling us that you definitely can know more than something died. You can tell a lot about it. I did mention during the debate once, maybe twice, about people who believe the Earth is 6,000 years old and people rode dinosaurs, and I was waiting for him to dispute that because Ken Ham will dispute that he says that. But if you notice, Ken Ham has books out that show people riding dinosaurs, children's book, Dinosaurs of Eden. And here Kent Hovind in one of his slides shows someone riding a dinosaur, And so, I was definitely ready for that if he came out. But there were, while he was doing his rebuttal, I was at that time going through different slides and trying to be prepared, that I had pre-prepared. So I did miss some opportunities. I made a couple mistakes. He asked me about carbon dating. He said, what was it? You know, could it be inaccurate? And I just kind of brushed it off. But I mean, yeah, it can be inaccurate. And he showed that to us. You know, if you use the method wrong, you will get bad results every time. So, you know, that was a missed opportunity there. But
use carbon dating, like your normal carbon dating that they use on things up to 50,000 years old. I mean, you're not going to use that on something which you suspect to be millions of years old.
Right, right.
You use potassium argon dating or something similar. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. And those methods, the KAR, the potassium argon method, is used, it's the most popular method. It has been for 50 years now. But there's also the argon, the 40 to 39. And that one doesn't rely on a parent-daughter relationship. You don't have to know that initially to do it. In fact, you can use that to determine the parent-daughter ratio that was initially. So we'll use that to cross-check the potassium argon dating. I think I brought that point up in the Hadar region and Kubifora and those areas. They've dated over 200 layers, volcanic layers, and even in between, they have magnetic reversals and things that they use to cross-check all that. So I mean, it's been dated using multiple methods, you know, and not just one method either. I mean, they use both the different KAR and the AR methods to cross-check it. So I brought up a couple other dating methods too that they've used for Homo naledi also the ones in Spain in the cave there. Caves are difficult to do, but you know they use other methods that don't rely on any initial parent-daughter ratio, and that's what Kent really harps on. You don't know when you started, so but he didn't go there. He just kind of, I guess, he realized wasn't a good thing to keep going with, you know. So yeah, he didn't go there.
Yeah. I mean, with how I understand us is like they will date the soil above and below the fossil that they found, and then do an average.
Well, they date wherever we can date. So, you know, and typically it's going to be above or below, but whatever layers are datable. So your sedimentary layer itself may not be datable, but as far as with a absolute method that they call it, you know, like the radiometric dating. So we find volcanic layers in there where we can date, and then using the law of superposition, in between, they're going to assign relative ages to it, relative dating. So, yeah.
Right. Bill, do you think, getting back to our friend, Kent Hovind, do you think apologists like him really believe what they're spouting, or do they have some other agenda, do you think?
You know, I definitely think they have an agenda. I mean, that's how they're making their living. So I like to call them creationism salesmen rather than evangelists or whatever. You know, you look at Ken Ham, you look at Kent Hovind. I mean, that's their living. Do they believe it? You know, I think some of them do. I think some of them don't. I have a really hard time believing that Eric Hovind, Kent's son, he just doesn't seem sincere. I mean, he just repeats things other people say. It's not like he seems like he's really ever studied it himself. He repeats what his father says.
It's a family business, isn't it?
Yeah, he repeats what Russ Miller says about geology. He repeats other people's things. And there's just not much sincerity there, you know? He's got his Genesis 3D movie coming out now, but he's begging for funding to get it in theaters. They've been working on it for 4 or 5 years. You know, every year they come out and beg for money for something. He was just slapped by the FDA yesterday. I don't know if you heard about that, but for selling B17, vitamin B17 on his website as a cure for cancer. Whoa. So he was slapped. The letter was published. Steve McRae did a hangout about it. I saw it all over the internet. You know, they sent him basically a cease and desist letter. You know, you can't do this. I mean, it's a violation of the law to promote vitamin B17 as a cure for cancer, which is what they have been doing. So, but yeah, I, you know, certain creationists, I think, probably believe it. Other ones, you know, it's hard. It's somebody like, especially the geologists, like a Steve Austin or an Andrew Snelling. These guys are trained and they have degrees in geology, and yet here they're out there talking about how the Earth is 60,000 years old. They're using their knowledge of geology to skirt around, you know, what we know, instead of you know, explaining it on real geological terms. I mean, I have a real hard time believing somebody like a Snelling or an Austin believes what they're saying. I think they're doing it as a business, definitely. So.
Wow. I recently interviewed Dr. Zach Moore on this subject, and I asked him about the practical uses for evolution, everyday uses. What, in your opinion, are the most important practical uses for evolution, uses that everyone has benefited from and continues to benefit from, including evolution?
Yeah, other than obviously medical benefits, you know, as far as understanding how viruses change, understanding how hereditary diseases are caused, you know, by studying evolution, the medical end of it there. But, you know, things like agriculture, I mean, a lot of that, of course, is not natural selection, it's artificial selection, but it's still following the same type of evolutionary pattern. So we've got agriculture. Conservation is another thing. You know, things are evolving. And in order to know how we're going to have further conservation in the future, we need to know how things are, where they're coming from. So I guess that's a way to put it. And with human evolution too, I mean, again, it's just we need to know where we came from to know where we're going and be able to predict where we're going. If we think we popped into existence and a few thousand years ago, and we're waiting to be raptured soon. It's always soon. It's always coming. You know. Then, I mean, there's just no there's no reason for people to really take care of the problems we have today. But if we realize that we're a product of evolution and that we're a product of our environment, you know. Climate change is an issue, and if we realize we're a product of our environment, that we need to do more to save our environment, you know, and to for future generations. So I just think you can't see the whole picture unless you understand evolution and you understand deep time and you know where we're coming from.
And I can just imagine anyone watching this who is a creationist, they would say, oh, you're talking about microevolution, you know, which is totally different. There's no such thing as macroevolution, which takes place over, as you said, deep time, millions of years. I mean, this is another thing which I get a lot. So, I mean, am I right in saying that macroevolution is just microevolution over a longer period of time?
Absolutely, yeah. And I tried to, there was one slide I brought up during the presentation that showed a row of skulls on an angle, but you know, Australopithecus is on one end and modern humans is on the other end. And I had, you know, on there it says microevolution, micro. And that's exactly what it is. If you look at each one next to each other, well, yeah, that's just microevolution. But when you start over here and you end over here, there's no disputing that we have a change of kind, you know, as creationists would call it. We went from Australopithecus to human. But I think one of the problems with the creationists is they just, if you believe the Earth is 6,000 years old, you don't have that concept of deep time. You know, a million years is a long time. 4 million years is a real long time. You know, 4 billion years is hard to even conceive. So,
yeah. Oh, Lord. Well, Bill, you, of course, belong to a lot of great organizations. You are the human origins expert at the Arizona Museum of Natural History. And, of course, you also run the website Creation Science Fiction. So what projects are you working on at the moment that you can tell us about?
Okay. Yeah, let me show you a couple things. In fact, I kind of meant to bring this up when we were talking about the things I like to do. So I have quite a, let's see here. Let me find, I'm working on the, there we go. I have quite a collection of fossils, huge, you know, fossil collection, rocks. I have stuff, like I have practically every layer of the Grand Canyon, but of course they weren't collected at the Grand Canyon. There's a lot of places in Arizona where you can collect the same layers. And I kind of collect animals too. I have my girlfriend calls it the zoo museum in my living room. This is part of my setup here. I have, I think 14 now terrariums and aquariums. Lots of different animals and things there. There's little poison dart frogs. I've got a couple different species of those guys. This is taken in my living room right here, this picture with a red-eyed tree frog. That's a little armadillo lizard. There's some corals in a saltwater aquarium, that different things. Fossils. This is a dinosaur coprolite from a camarasaur.
Dinosaur and, poo.
Yep, dinosaur poop right there. So got a big chunk of those. I picked up that at the Tucson, huge show down in Tucson every year, the Tucson Gem and Mineral Show. I collect Green River fossils, so Green River Formation. There's several different ones there. Let's see. There's a little pom-pom crab, they call them. They actually are a little crab that's native to around Hawaii, and they carry a little anemone in each hand. To capture food and stuff. So that's kind of a neat little thing. He's quite a bit bigger now, but a bearded dragon I have. Again, there's a little red-eyed tree frog. I love that picture. It's like National Geographic in my living room. So here's something you don't see every day, a hermit crab riding a flame scallop. So
no, you don't see that every day.
Right. This is Roxy the Oxalotl, and she's one of my favorites. I've had her for about probably 3 years now, and they call them a Mexican walking fish, but they're actually a salamander where the larval stage never morphs into an adult. So, but they walk and swim around in the bottom of the tank there. So, trilobites, I've got a lot of trilobites and just other different fossils too. So,
I love trilobites. There's so many different species, and I think they keep finding them. Isn't that right? All these weird and wonderful shapes.
Oh yeah. Yeah. All sorts of them. There's literally hundreds of different types of, trilobites there. And then what I'm working on now, in fact, next week, I'm doing an excavation with the New Mexico Museum of Natural History on some tracks that I found. And we'll bring that up here. And
you discovered that was really,
yeah, I was fishing with my son up at, I can't even say the name of the lake right now because I'm sworn to secrecy until they
of course.
Until the excavation is done here. But I was actually with my son fishing up one of the lakes on the Mogollon Rim here. And I looked down and saw tracks by my feet in the sandstone. And they were real faded. They weren't good ones. But I could see left, right, left, right. And I went home, you know, that night. And I looked up the geological survey map of the area to see what the layer was, how old it was. I had no idea, but you know, I had the elevation, everything else. I had an altimeter and phone app, so I was able to get the elevation and all that stuff while I was there. Went home and looked it up, and it was Coconino sandstone, which is famous for tracks, but none had been found in this actual region before in that area. And so, doing some studying on it, I went back and I ended up spending about 200 hours that summer uncovering slabs. This one right here, I only uncovered maybe the bottom foot or so of it there. But this particular slab is about 10 feet wide by about 7 feet tall and has probably about 100 tracks on it. This slide here has some of the best ones that they've ever found as far as the lower left down there. This one is, we ended up uncovering probably about 50% of that. I had seen the partial tracks that were in the upper right there, or not as good tracks there, but just dusting and clearing off the slabs, I uncovered the rest of it there. There's a close-up of the really good ones there. Wow. And they made it look like they were made yesterday. But we found them. I found them. There's one that's 1 centimeter wide. So,
do you have any idea what type of animal?
Yeah, I've got that. Let's see. That was the next slide. we don't know exactly because there are tracks and we don't have any fossil remains. There are literally no vertebrate remains in the Coconino sandstone. So that's why it's one of my favorite topics to discuss when people come up with the flood. But this was a shoreline area. I can actually go to the edge of the Mogollon Rim right about 2 miles from where this lake is, and you can see where the road is there alongside of the rim as it's going up. You can see alternating layers of sandstone and shale where it was near the edge of an inland sea, and it would recede and advance at different times. So it was like a shoreline deposit. So these are the early mammal-like reptiles. There were a lot of different species, but again, we don't know exactly what it is.
Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I could have found tracks of something that was our ancestor actually, which is kind of really cool. Again, they've been found up towards the Grand Canyon. They've been found in Utah, New Mexico, but not before in this particular region of Arizona. Here's a little overview of several different ones. The ones on the lower right down here, those are the ones that Spencer Lucas, he's the curator of paleontology for the New Mexico Museum of Natural History, he thinks that those could be amphibian. They definitely are different than the other tracks. They seem to have more of a rounded end to the digits there. And if that's true, it would be the first amphibian tracks ever found in the Coconino sandstone. But again, it was shoreline deposit, so it wasn't like they were out in the middle of the desert, you know, so it could be possible that it was amphibians. We're doing the excavation next Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Myself, Spencer Lucas, from the New Mexico Museum of Natural History, and he's got two paleo track experts coming up from Brazil to help on this. The reason I'm working with them and not the Arizona Museum of Natural History is the one in New Mexico here has the largest collection of Permian footprints in the world, and Spencer's like the national authority on Permian footprints. So I actually talked with the local museum here that I work with, and they recommended I talk to him only because he's basically the expert on it, could help me out. And once he saw these, he went crazy. He says, oh my gosh, looking at these pictures, he's got like four papers he thinks he can write, you know, on this just because of the different types. Again, I found them up from about 1 centimeter to 3 inches wide and four different ichnotaxa, which is what they assign instead of species, they assign an ichnotaxa to it. Ichnology, that's what they use as the term instead of species. So yeah, I'm working, you're going to be talking more with him about what species we believe it is. And I'm actually writing a book on this, writing a booklet. It looks like it's going to be about 60 to 70 pages. It'll be a soft cover, a lot of photographs of the tracks, but kind of a basic geological history of the Mogollon Rim area there, the Coconino sandstone, the different types of tracks, you know, everything from the discovery of the tracks to what they could have been, as well as the excavation itself, and then ending up in the museum at the end. So I'm about halfway through with it, and next week I'll be able to put in the parts and the images about the excavation, and then within a couple months they should be on display in the museum, so that should be nice.
Oh, gosh. Well, congratulations for that, Bill. I mean, we're definitely going to keep a close eye on that. And hopefully, I mean, you're going to be publishing that as soon as you can.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and again, there's the importance about learning about this. I mean, this is in a lake that is visited by, you know, hundreds of people every week. I mean, going fishing. And people had to have seen this before. I mean, some of them at least, not all the ones I uncovered, but people had to have seen some of these things. And yet, without knowing about the history of it and the geology of it and everything, they just walk right on by, and this would have been lost. You know, I just happened to stumble on some really bad ones, and I was interested enough to go out there and look for more. And like I said, I spent about 200 hours on it, and it just blew me away. Every time I went up there, I kept finding more. I found 18 sets of tracks total. Probably, I would say because there's so many on that one slab, I would say probably between 250 and 300 individual prints I found over 18 sets. So, and it's all in a quarter mile stretch of this lake. I walked the entire lake, and I mean, it's all one area. But again, without people studying this and the knowledge, having the knowledge to recognize it, things like that would be lost. We'd never learn from it. So,
wow. That is really fascinating. And I just got to say, Bill, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this, about your work. And I just want to thank you for everything that you do. I'll put links to your website and the YouTube channel in the description below for people to follow up. Okay. And lastly, and I always do this in my interviews, if there's anybody who comes across this interview and is still, in this case, reluctant to accept evolution as a fact, what would you say to them right now?
What would I say if they're still reluctant?
You're on the spot, man.
I guess, you know, look at it with an open mind. And that's the hardest thing to do, I think, you know, because we all have presuppositions. We all, you know, by the time you're my age, I mean, you're kind of set in your ways. I think by the time people are 20, they're pretty much set in their ways. But I mean, I just would hope that people would actually look at what the other side is saying. Look at what, you know, science is telling us, and leave the creationist literature behind for a while, because it is designed to, you know, counter what the scientists are saying, but it's not based in reality. I mean, to me, so I would just say, you know, please look at it with an open mind and do your own research. Don't rely on what people like Kent Hovind and Ken Ham are telling you.
Absolutely. Bill, thank you once again, and we'll catch up with you hopefully in the very near future.
All right, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Okay, then. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.